a lot opinionated, and I'm a lot passionate about politics. My friends and family tease me about this and try and wind me up. My brother is in Washington, D.C. this week for work, and he sent me these pictures. Oh, no, that's not them. Go back one. Well, maybe I did it the wrong way around. There. He asked me which hat I would like. I'm the person who has hung up on my mum during a political discussion. And if you've met my dear, sweet, little, quiet mum, it's a bit of a shocking thing. I'm the person who has been chasing one of the political parties to put a sign up on our fence because there are heaps of signs for the other parties around and I don't really like it. I'm also the person, who can go back now, who has fantasies about going out and defacing other parties' signs with googly eyes and Sharpie pens. So I'm trying to work out the bylaws of what you can and can't do. Yes. And I'm realising that I can be quite binary in my thinking about this. In my head, there's the right way and the other. And the political situation these days feeds this binary thinking, really. And as I've thought about this, I've hoped to develop a more nuanced, less violent way of viewing politics and the people involved. How do I love my political enemies? Part of the reason I put my name down for this was I wanted to think about it a little more. And the other was a conversation that I've had this year and a realisation that I've had. This week, we're looking at Jesus' interaction with Levi the tax collector, who becomes Matthew, who's also known as Matthew, in Luke 5. Jesus calls Levi to be one of his disciples and also goes to his house and has a big dinner with Levi's friends and acquaintances. I must confess, I don't think a lot about the disciples as a group. I notice Peter because he keeps diving in feet first, and James and John because they were the sons of Zebedee, and that's one of Mike's favourite names. We had a cat called Zebedee, and I liked the magic roundabout character Zebedee. But in my head, when I think about the disciples, I imagine them like a bunch of ducklings following Jesus, their mama duck. And they sort of are a little bit wobbly and a little bit clueless and a little bit meh. They're not fleshed out characters in my head. And then I read this, and when I was talking with Sean, I realised that they probably disliked, disagreed, and debated with each other constantly. They were people who grew up and lived in such different cultural communities. They had different ideologies, different friends, different ways of thinking about how life should be lived. James, can we play? Liz sent me, not knowing I was going to be sharing this, Liz sent me this little reel that you might... Like, if Jesus' disciples were in the end of an 80s movie. It goes round and round and round. There's another one of them as well. We know that one of them, Simon, was a zealot. He was a fierce political activist, passionate in his desire to protect the purity of Jewish culture and his hatred of the Roman Empire. Scholars also think that some of the others were probably really politically active too and desired to be free from the oppression of Rome. And a large number were fishermen who were drawn by their brothers and friends to hear Jesus' words, maybe not known for their education because they probably left to work in their father's business quite early on. A couple may have been scholars too, and then and Matthew, Levi, is sort of, he would have had a reasonable education. He kept an account of Jesus' life that became the Gospel of Matthew that we have today. He was working as a tax collector, so working for the Roman Empire, keeping the people of Israel subjugated by forcing them to give money to Rome. He was part of a group who were hated and despised by the Jewish leaders and Jewish activists. And you can just imagine the murmurings that might have gone around the disciples that were already called when he was brought into the group. Maybe some of them found it really hard to go and have dinner at his place that night. There's a woman that I know who has three grown-up sons. Two of them are really involved in politics at completely different ends of the political spectrum. And I found it very interesting to talk to her about how they get along. Remember, I'm the person who hung up on my mother. So she speaks about how much they enjoy being together as a family, how they have really robust debates, but also really like each other. How one of the brothers helped the other with his party billboards. How they support each other, how they deal with the media's portrayal of them, and how they know and respect the other person deep down and don't get overwhelmed by the political noise. And maybe that's the norm for families, and all of you are saying, oh, come on, Helen, of course, that's how families work. But I get really twisty inside about this. I find it hard to go fully, you know, love and appreciate the person and seeing, am I condoning what they think and how I disagree with them? And I get all messy in my head. And when I read this back, I realise the sin of judging people, and I am grateful that we are going to share communion after this so I can receive God's grace and forgiveness as I need every day. And of course, I know the words of Jesus, that people will know you're my followers by the way you love one another. And I come back to my surprise at those disciples and how challenging that would have been. They would have not naturally sat around a fire singing Kumbaya together. They may have been naturally suspicious of each other. They may have tried to hurt each other. They may have been known to each other and people as people to kind of watch out for or despise. Loving each other would have been a very difficult exercise day in and out for this group. There's a poem by, There's a poem by Michael Lunig that says, love one another and you will be happy. It is simple and as difficult as that. There is no other way. So I read it again. Love one another and you will be happy. It is as simple and as difficult as that. There is no other way. I think that says it all, really. What a difficult thing to do, but it is the space we're invited into. My spiritual director, Trish, gave me this prayer exercise. He said, sit, feet grounded on the ground, my hands open, and I spend some time reflecting that I am beloved. And then I turn my mind and my heart to those around me, those I know, those I love, those I struggle with, and I reflect, you are beloved. And finally, I allow myself to open up to the world around me, those I admire, those I despise, every person in this whole world, and reflect, all are beloved. Each and everyone is beloved to God. So in light of everyone being deeply loved by God, being an image bearer of God with the breath of God in their lungs, how do we disagree with one another? We don't all see the world the same, and there may be many things we disagree on. So how do we talk about them? And then deeper than that, how do we take a stand against a system or a policy or an opinion that we think is harmful to people or the world? How do we deal with our anger? I'm thinking about the Jesus clearing the temple kind of anger, that righteous anger at injustice that we see around us. And after all that, how do we still love people, live with them, celebrate their joys, and disagree with most of what they have to say still? I listened to a TED talk, and the interview was with Megan Phelps Roper, and then also she did another interview with Louis Theroux, and it's really good to listen to. She's the daughter of some of the founding members of the Westboro Baptist Church in the United States that actively protest using disgusting hate speech against others. She talks about how she started using Twitter as a way to share her church's message more broadly. Read that, have arguments with people, and was surprised by some of the people who asked her questions and had a civil and friendly disagreement with her that lacked the vitriol she was expecting. She got plenty of vitriol too. She came for a fight and was disarmed by the friendship. And as these conversations grew, they opened her gently to see the humanity of the people she was disagreeing with. And that led for her to question what she had been told about the outside world. The other. It turned her life upside down, and she has left her family in that church and started a new life with a complete completely different way of seeing the world. Of huge cost to her because she's had to walk away from her family and they have turned their backs on her. But there was something about the kindness in that experience that opened her up to a new way of looking at the world. She talks about the power of engaging the other. And I know that's not the same as a system that we need to stand for or injustice that we need to stand up against. But it does give me a glimpse of how my day-to-day interactions with family and people I encounter needs to be. And I've sat in the weeds preparing this talk, kind of going round and round in circles and wondering how to communicate honestly who I am, but also share something that might be a little bit inspiring. And I was listening to a podcast and I heard a quote from Henry Nouwen that really sort of sliced through all the angst and finally allowed me to look up and realise that I am completely human and I am not God, and God is God. And this is Henry Nouwen, and he is reflecting on Jesus speaking to the disciples on the road to Emmaus. And he says, then something happens, something shifts. The stranger begins to speak, and his words ask for serious attention. He has listened to them, and now they listen to him. His words are very clear and straightforward. He speaks of things they already knew, their long past with all that had happened during the centuries before they were born. The story of Moses who led their people to freedom, and the story of the prophets who challenged their people never to let go of their dearly acquired freedom. It was an all too familiar story. Still, it sounded as if they were hearing it for the first time. The difference lay in the storyteller, a stranger appearing from nowhere, yet someone who somehow seems closer than anyone who had ever told that story. The loss, the grief, the guilt, the fear, the glimpses of hope and the many unanswered questions that battled for attention in their restless minds, all of these were lifted up by the stranger and placed in the context of a story much larger than their own. What had seemed so confusing began to offer new horizons. What had seemed so oppressive began to feel liberating. And what seemed so extremely sad began to take on the quality of joy. As he talked to them, they gradually came to know that their little lives weren't as little as they had thought, but part of a great mystery that not only embraced many generations, but stretched itself out from eternity to eternity. The stranger didn't say that there was no reason for sadness, but that their sadness was part of a larger sadness in which joy was hidden. The stranger didn't say that the death they were mourning wasn't real, but it was a death that inaugurated even more life, real life. The stranger didn't say that they hadn't lost a friend who had given them new courage and new hope, but that this loss would create a way to a relationship far beyond any friendship they had ever experienced. Never did the stranger deny what they told him. To the contrary, he affirmed it as part of a much larger story, even in which they were allowed to play a unique role. The difference is not denying the hard stuff, but seeing the deeper love and mystery of God that underpins it all. There is so much pain, both in us and in this world. There's so much we don't understand, and we can feel really hopeless. But that quotes like these cause a shift in our thinking and in our hearts that point us to a loving God who is intimately present in every moment and who holds us in the world in their loving hands. It reminds us to keep going, to do the next right thing, to apologize when we get it wrong, and to notice the glimmers of God making all things new. Finally, I am not the person to follow in these issues and get down in the mud and feed on the trash by clicking too many times, by filling my ears and my headspace with noise and information. I can feed my own perspectives, my own biases, and continue to hold political issues as a binary idea. I can judge people rather than hear their stories and see them as fully beloved of God, in need of as much grace as I need to offer myself. I need to listen to people like Henri Nouwen and lift my head. who we listen to, who we allow to speak in our lives and in our hearts, who we spend time with makes a difference in how we can be. Maybe the disciples, as they focused on Jesus and walked alongside him, learnt to live together, loving each other with all their differences in a way that shined the light on the life and words of Jesus. I'm sure they mucked up. I'm sure they would have had to work at it. And I'm sure it was as simple and as difficult for them as it is for us. May we experience the love and grace from God to do this a little bit more today and this week ahead. So I had a couple of questions that I thought I'd love to hear your perspectives on. It's going to lead into Barstool, isn't it, Sean? It might be part of your Barstool conversation, or it might be just something that you've been thinking of. How do you have conversations with someone you disagree with at a fundamental level? How do you love them? And whose voices do you find lead you to a place of deeper love in difficult situations? So as we, you know, we have the Barstool here as a place that you can come and share what's going on in your lives and share the joys and share the sorrows, and we will stand with you or sit with you and support you in those spaces. And you might like to reflect on these questions. You might like to just say something else that's been happening for you. The only rules that we have are to be honest and to be brief. That the Barstool is open.
I'm not specifically addressing this, although it's interesting as a wee factor, but I guess I've just got some news, family news really, which is that I am being transferred with my work. So I'm heading off to Brisbane in early November, and Andrew and Eddie are going to be coming to join me in, I'm coming back for Christmas and we're going over together in early January. So it's a big change for our family. It's probably just for a couple of years, but there's no particular time frame on it. We'd probably be guided just by how Eddie's going at school, I think, is what we're thinking. So yeah, it's a big change. We'll leave Sophie here. Sophie gets the house. and a role supporting Jill as well, which Sophie's up for, which is fantastic. They've got a really good relationship, so that's good. And yeah, I'm going to miss Lizzie, Celia, all of you. But it's something that's come through with my work that just feels right. And feel free to talk to me more about that, because it's interesting. When I first took a job a few years ago, you know, working for a Caterpillar dealership with heavy machinery, I never really knew what might happen. And some amazing things have actually happened in the space with my work. Just, you know, like one little person, I feel like I've actually been able to make a difference. And now they want me to go and help in Australia, which is really exciting. So I saw this job advertised many years ago. I was like, I'm not interested in machinery. Never worked with a blue-collar workforce, and it's been a wonderful experience for me professionally, and it's cool. The Australians are like, oh, we want to be more like you in New Zealand, so that's pretty cool. So so that's, yeah, awesome for me, and really nice. So, yeah, so I guess that's just a big change. I'd love you guys to support Andrew when I'm away, because it's going to be hard for him. And we'll come back quite regularly. Eddie's going to come back for Easter camp, so that'll be good. Yeah.
I got 3 baskets at basketball on Friday.
Kia ora e te whānau, I'm Jill. Maybe this little story will speak for itself, so I'll try not to put my spin on it. But I had an experience at work this week at Riccarton High, where I'm filling in for the end of the year at Student Services. And this week I've had the privilege, or the challenge, however I look at it each day, of being responsible for those delightful teenagers who are referred. And I'm always astounded, really, at where I learn lessons that impact me the most, and it's often in the least expected places. So I had a 15-year-old recidivist offender come to my office, having been referred with his mate, who they both had a bit of a fisticuffs with. This particular young man had stolen his mate's computer, and then he'd punched him, and then he'd called him some very unfortunate names. And so I separated them both, and this particular offender just said, "I just need some space, miss." I said, "That's all right, my love. Let's take you down to the contract room. Here's your piece of paper that you need to write out the incident about." I said, "But you probably need to appreciate that not every thought that comes into your mind needs to be acted on, and not everything you're thinking needs to come out your mouth. So maybe just write about what happened, how it's impacted the other person, but how has it impacted you, and what can you do about it?" So I wasn't really hopeful that I'd get much of an answer back. But when I read the paper, I was surprised. But he came back down out of the contract room with tears in his eyes. I think I'm sharing this because most of what Helen said, I feel the story just sits with. And Helen, you gave a quote, "Love one another. It's as easy and as difficult as that. There is no other way." So this so-called tough recidivist offender came with tears in his eyes. I said, "Mate, what's the matter? Do you want to have a chat?" He goes, "Nope, I just want to apologize." And I said, "You want to apologize?" He goes, "Yes, what I did was wrong, and he's my friend, and I want to say sorry." So there's your opportunity. And I watched, feels a bit emotional. Up he went to his mate, reached out his hand, they hugged, gave each other the fist pump and the semi-gang hug, and off they went. So I feel very humbled to have witnessed something and need to take my own advice that not everything I think needs to be acted on or spoken.
So I guess you all know me. I'm Adrian. So please pray for my dad, who's working in Papua New Guinea. He worked there before many years ago, and this is his first time going back there. So please continue praying for him. And also, this is William the Wolf. He wants to say hi. That's what he says. I guess he wants to say something. Hey? Can anyone hear him? Oh, what? They can't hear you? What do you say? Huh? Okay, it's okay. Anyway, I have good news for you. I performed the Won't Live Forever by Dear Jane last Friday with my band, which is successful.
So I had, I've just got a short story to share as well, and it feels like a bit of a miracle story, and I'm not quite sure where to sit with it, but just want to share it, because sometimes we need to share the good news as well, don't we? As you know, I had a really difficult relationship with my workplace over sort of a series of years, and I ended up going to the board as a whistleblower around abuse and distress, mental distress of staff. And the person who was perpetrating, was leading people to feel that way, eventually